looked at him and shook my head. "Let's get out of here," I said. "You've stirred the hornet's nest." With our group experiencing a division from the tension of our earlier discussion about firearms, we clicked up for the afternoon's hiking. Walt and Katie hiked together, while my group stayed to themselves. We made good time, chugging away like machines and cresting a 4,000-plus-foot peak known as the Priest. By early evening, we gradually lost elevation and were within an hour's walk of the Blue Ridge Parkway. My plan was to overnight here, a good distance from the road where we would hopefully be safer. Tomorrow we would head for the Blue Ridge Parkway and follow it until we came to another road that would descend even further. If all went well, by nightfall we would be at my friend Lloyd's place. We had yo-yoed with Walt and Katie all afternoon, taking turns between our group leading and them taking the lead. I was in the lead when I reached the point where my GPS told me I was as close to the Blue Ridge Parkway as I wanted to get. I didn't know for sure that the road was being utilized by travelers, but my gut told me to avoid people when possible. Tonight it was possible to avoid them. Tomorrow it might not be. "Before you set up your gear, I have a plan," I told the group when we'd all made it to the clearing. "I don't think we should set up right here beside the trail." They stared at me blankly. "We need to pitch camp here at this clearing, but I think we need to sleep a little further back in the concealment of the woods," I continued. "My gut tells me we might have company tonight." "Those men?" Katie asked. "Aren't you being a little paranoid?" I shook my head. "No, I'm not. Gary, did you notice the firearms?" Gary's face was slick with sweat, and he appeared exhausted. "Single-shot shotgun," he stated. "Looked like a 12-gauge Harrington and Richardson or something similar. The lever gun was probably a Rossi 30-30. I know it wasn't a Winchester because I'm familiar with those guns." "Are those expensive guns?" I asked. "No," he said, shaking his head. "The shotgun's probably something you could pick up for under $100. The Rossi's a little more, but still on the low end of the price scale." "Do you think those guys were locals or backpackers?" I asked Walt. "Locals would be my guess," he said. "They probably just wandered up here from their parents' homes to look for game, like they said." "Did you see their packs?" "I saw they had packs," he replied. "Didn't see what brand." "Gregory Baltoros," I said. "You ever price one?" "We did," Katie said with surprise. "They were close to $350 each. What about the sleeping pads tied to those packs? Did you get a look at them?" No one said anything. "I did," I said, answering my own question. "They were Thermarest NeoAir, one on each pack. Anyone ever price one of those?" Katie replied again. "Around $100 each." "So we're at nearly $1,000 and we're not even to the contents of the packs yet," I said. "Who carries that kind of gear, local hunters or through hikers?" The group responded with a dawning recognition of where I was going with this. Their faces wrinkled and their expressions grew dark. "You think they may have killed hikers and taken their gear?" Walt asked. "Well, they got it somehow, and I doubt anyone would give up that kind of gear willingly." Randy and Gary said nothing, clearly aware enough at this point in our journey that they should not be surprised with this possible scenario. They knew what people were capable of. We'd seen it with our own eyes.
"What do you propose?" Gary asked.
I took off my pack and set it in the cleared center of what was obviously an established and well-used campsite. It was right beside the trail and large enough for group camping. A fire pit of blackened rocks formed a ring in the center. "I think Walt and Katie should set their tent up here just as they would if they were camping. We pitch a tarp here in an A-shape that restricts anyone's ability to easily see inside it. We can leave a fire smoldering here and give the entire camp the appearance that we sacked out right here for the night," I said.
"But we don't?" Randy asked.
"No, we make a rough camp about 100 feet over in that direction. It's not likely to rain tonight, so we don't really need a cover over us. We can lay out a tarp and sleep on it with our blankets. I want to be far enough that they won't stumble on us if they come up here, but close enough to know if anything crazy happens." The group pondered this.
"If they do come and they find empty tents, won't they just keep looking for us?" Walt asked. "Won't we still be in danger?"
"We'll post a watch," Gary said.
Exactly, I said. With a group this size, a 90-minute shift should be sufficient. We rotate in and out until morning.
I won't carry a gun, Walt announced defiantly.
I couldn't stifle a laugh, but it was not a friendly laugh.
I wouldn't give you a gun, I said.
I'd rather deal with an armed intruder than deal with someone who's scared of guns, doesn't know shit about guns, and is wandering around my own camp with one. Both are dangerous.
Walt's virtue deflated. With nothing else to say, he dropped his pack and removed his tent, clearly too beat to argue. His action broke our inertia, and we began setting up our own decoy shelter. Since we weren't actually intending to sleep in them, it went pretty fast. Walt and Katie had their tent up in a matter of minutes. For our own shelter, Gary strung paracord between two trees, draped a tarp over it, and weighted the ends down with rocks. Randy packed both ends with leaves to make it appear that we had created a leafy sleeping pad. When we were done, we moved as a group to an area a little deeper in the woods. We quickly located a sufficient spot and spent a few minutes dragging branches and debris out of the way. The area was covered in a thick moss that made any further padding unnecessary. We just spread our Tyvek tarp over the moss and had a surprisingly comfortable bed. We offered to share with Walt and Katie, but they found their own spot about a dozen feet away and rolled their sleeping bags directly out onto the moss. Walt and Katie were out of provisions, so I had planned on digging into my stash of rice and beans for dinner. After some discussion, we agreed that we could probably build a fire in the fire ring of the established camp where our decoy shelters were set up. Leaving some burning embers in there would only help create the picture of it being our actual camp, if we did end up having visitors that night. Using a butane lighter and twigs, we had a blaze going in no time. Gary ended up digging into his stash for the beans, and I provided the rice. He also had a pot about the size of mine in his own pack. Both pots had wire bales on the top for lifting them, so we rigged a system for hanging the pots over the fire. It was easier to control the temperature if you had the ability to raise and lower the pot. Both the rice and beans took some time to cook, so we spent that time going over the details of the watch and determining where the sentry would be positioned. By the time dinner was cooked, darkness was beginning to fall. We built up the fire in the decoy camp, scraped our pots clean, and rinsed them with some of our water. Then we all headed back to bivvy further in the woods. The plan was that Katie would take the first watch, then Walt, followed by me, Gary, and finally Randy. As we settled down for the night, I checked the chamber on my Beretta and made sure there was one in the pipe. I considered the option of sleeping with it tucked under my side, but decided instead to leave it in the holster. If I awoke and took off running in a half-dazed state, I didn't want to forget the pistol and have to come back for it. In my exhausted state, this was as far as I got in turning the day's events around in my head. I rested my head on my pack and was out in just a couple of minutes. It was a shot that woke me. It was immediately followed by more in rapid succession. I knew at least one shot was from a shotgun. What I was hearing now sounded like a pistol. I bolted upright, flinging my blanket to the side. My first reaction was to reach for my headlight, but I hesitated, not wanting to have a blazing target on my forehead. My left hand shot out, patting along the ground cloth for Randy, who should have been beside me. Her spot was empty, only a crumpled blanket left. There was screaming, a man screaming.
"Gary!" I hissed.
"I'm here," he said. "There's a fire. Something's burning."
We stood, rising unsteadily on our stiff muscles on the uneven and unfamiliar terrain. I could see that Walt and Katie's empty tent was on fire. I stumbled toward it. In the dim glow, I could see Walt seated in the spot that we had designated for a sentry. He was frozen in terror, the terror of a man jolted from his sleep.
"Where the fuck is Randy?" I whispered.
Walt shook his head rapidly, but no words came out. I would have to deal with him later.
"Randy," I whispered.
A scream came again from the woods past the burning tent. The same man's scream. My Beretta was in my hand. I'd taken it from the holster at some point. I could not see Randy in the light from the now fading fire, and I didn't want to go charging out into the open without knowing what was going on.
I dropped to a crouch and started forward, staying concealed as best I could. Another shot rang out, this one definitely from a high-powered rifle. It was followed by another that struck a tree high over my head. The shooter clearly had no one in his sights. He was firing randomly.
"Randy," I said in a louder voice.
"Jim, where the hell are you, Randy?"
More screaming.
"You fucking bitch," the man yelled. "You shot me."
Ahead and to my left, I saw a flashlight illuminated and held in the air. She waved it around, trying to get my attention.
"Turn that off and stay down," I told her. "I'm coming."
I scrambled toward her position, branches raking me across the face and neck. When I got to her side, I could barely see her, but I could tell she was rolling around on her back, her hands scrabbling at her waist. I dropped to her side.
"Are you hit?"
I asked urgently.
"No, damn it," she hissed. "I'm trying to get my freaking pants back on."
"What happened?" I asked.
"Who is that screaming?"
She cursed and wallowed some more, then managed to get her pants fastened and roll over into a sitting position.
"There was someone out there," she said, panic in her voice. "I heard a lighter, and I thought someone was smoking."
"Guys," Gary whispered loudly from behind us, "you okay? What's going on?"
"Keep low," I said. "There's someone still out there."
"I'm coming to you," Gary said. "Don't shoot me."
There was the sound of movement in the underbrush behind us, and Gary emerged and knelt beside us.
"What happened?" he asked.
"I was working on that," I said. "Randy hasn't told me yet." Gary looked at Randy. She was scared, her eyes wild in the diffused light of my covered headlamp.
"I was up, and I heard the sound of a cigarette lighter being flicked," she said. "In the quiet, I could hear it clear as day."
"Why were you up? I haven't done my watch yet, so it couldn't have been your turn."
"Damn it, I had to go to the bathroom," she said in a hostile whisper. "I haven't been in days. I wanted some privacy, so I got up to go. Walt was asleep on his watch. I was going to wake you up and tell you when I was done, but then everything went crazy."
"Okay," I said. "Sorry I asked. Keep going."
"So I hear this lighter and think that someone's smoking. I'm about out of cigarettes, so I was excited to think that Walt and Katie might have some. I raise up from where I'm squatted and take a look and see someone's flicking a lighter, but it's over next to that tent. Then the tent starts glowing."
"They set it on fire?" Gary asked.
"Yes. Then while the fire was spreading, one of these guys from earlier steps out from behind it with a shotgun and fires right into the side of it."
That must have been the shot that woke me.
"I was so scared that I must have made a noise," she continued. "He looked right at me, his shotgun pointed at me."
"You had the pistol I gave you earlier?" I asked. She nodded.
"I had it in my hand because I was scared a bear would sneak up on me."
"Did you fire at him?" Gary asked.
"Hell yeah," she said. "I was afraid he was going to shoot me. I just pointed the gun at him and started shooting. He kind of fell or jumped or something, and then I could see the other guy was behind him, so I just kept shooting at him until the gun stopped."
"Where's the gun now?" I asked. She reached behind her and pulled it from her back pocket.
"I needed both hands to get my pants back on," she said.
The urgency of the screaming was diminishing, the cries more sporadic. There were attempts at words, wet and garbled, the sound of a man drowning in his own blood. "We need to take a look," I said to Gary. He nodded. "Without getting killed," I added. He nodded again. "You stay here," I told him. "I'm going back to my pack to get something." Without waiting for a response, I felt my way back in the direction I'd come from, trying to avoid taking any branches in the eye. I finally saw the white glow of my Tyvek sheet and reached down for my pack. In one of the outside pockets, I felt for a black zipper pouch with a lanyard string attached to it. When I found the string, I tugged the pouch free, unzipped it, and removed a Bushnell night vision monocular from it. I hung the lanyard string around my neck and headed back toward Gary and Randy. "Night vision," I stated, reaching for the on button.
"Night vision?"
Randy asked sarcastically.
"Really?"
"Really. Nothing fancy, nothing like the soldiers wear." Once the monocular screen came to life, I scanned the woods in the direction of the burned tent. I could see a few glowing embers around the outline of the tent, but not much starlight penetrated the thick canopy of trees. A second button on the monocular activated an infrared spotlight. The spotlight greatly increased the effectiveness of the scope and was invisible to anyone not wearing night vision. With the assistance of the IR illuminator, I could now see a pair of legs extending from the brush past the tent. The legs slowly drew up at the knees and then relaxed again. The screaming was nearly gone now, replaced by crying. I scanned the rest of the bushes and couldn't see anyone else. I passed the monocular to Gary. "Take a look," I said. "I only see the one guy." Gary put the scope to his eye. "Damn," he whispered. "This thing is cool." "How much was it?" "Under $150. It's only first generation, so it's kind of cheesy."
"It does the job," he said.
"We know what's out there now."
"Not exactly," I said. "We're missing one guy."
There was another choked cry from the man lying in the weeds near the burned tent. He was down, but not out. I kept the monocular to my eye, holding it with my left hand, the Beretta in my right. I stood and advanced slowly. The poor optical quality of the monocular would be difficult to use if I was running, but it was more than capable of dealing with the slow speed I was moving at now. The man was less than 30 feet away, and as I turned around a cluster of rhododendron, I found him sprawled on the trail, his legs still moving without purpose, his hands curling and uncurling. His eyes were open, his chest saturated with blood that bubbled when he breathed. Blood came from his mouth and ran down his ears, cheeks, and neck. There were multiple wounds, but one was clearly a lung shot, fatal in these conditions. I scanned the bushes around me for as far as the IR illuminator would go. I saw no one.
"I can't see anyone," I called out. "Gary, you come up. You can use your light, but keep it low."
Gary closed the distance quickly, his Glock held at the ready. When he reached me, he ran his light over the wounded man.
"Jesus Christ," he whispered.
I put the night vision in Gary's hand.
"Take a position over there near the trail, and keep an eye out with this thing. We're going to start packing gear. I think it's time to get moving."
Gary moved toward another clump of bushes to set up a watch. I removed my headlight and turned it on, aiming it down toward the ground to cut down on how much stray light flew around. I turned around to head for my gear and ran straight into Randy. She'd been standing immediately behind me, her flashlight glued to the face and chest of the man she'd shot. She stumbled backward, and I reached for her, gripping her arm and steadying her. She pulled away, twisting, and spraying vomit into the weeds. I stepped back and gave her a moment. While she retched and gagged, Walt and Katie approached with another light.
"Get her some water," I said to them. "There's a bottle beside my pack."
Walt hurried off.
"He's not dead," Randy said, wiping her mouth with her sleeve.
"No," I said, "he's not."
"I did that," she said in a low voice.
"You had to do that," I corrected. "He made you do that."
"He's my daughter's age," she said sadly.
"He's likely a murderer, and he got what he deserved." Katie approached with the water bottle Walt had retrieved. Walt was apparently too scared to come near us. That was insightful on his part. This was partly his fault for falling asleep on his watch, and I felt like I could hurt him for endangering all our lives. I took the water bottle and passed it to Randy. She washed out her mouth and spat in the bushes. I could see tears in her eyes when she turned back to me.
"What are we going to do with him?" she asked.
"We're going to leave him," I said calmly.
"But..."
"But what?" I interrupted. "There's no 911, no ambulances up here, and I'm not carrying a man that tried to kill us. I'm also not particularly interested in putting a bullet in his head to put him out of his misery. I'm not so hardened yet that I can do that."
"You seem like it," she said, catching my eye.
"Seem how?"
"Like you're good at this," she said.
"Like you were ready for this.
Almost like you enjoy it."
I shook my head. "I don't enjoy this. Things in the world weren't perfect, but they were better than this. I may be a little bit better prepared than the next guy, but that's because I worked at it. I read a lot of books. I watched a lot of videos. I chose to spend money on preparing for things like this rather than wasting it on a boat or a Harley or renting a house at the beach."
"You weren't in the military?"
I laughed at that.
To anyone who had been in the military, it would probably be very obvious that I had not been in the military. But Randy was sincere in her question. No, I was never in the military, I told her. I'm not a soldier. I'm a paranoid hillbilly wanting to get home to my family. And under the right circumstances, a determined father is every bit as dangerous as the most highly trained soldier. She took a deep breath and braced herself. Then maybe a determined grandmother can survive, too. A determined grandmother may have saved some lives tonight, I told her. Now harden the fuck up, Granny, and let's get out of here. I patted her on the shoulder. When I did, she dropped the beam of her light from the gasping man on the ground, turned, and went to pack her gear. Within 15 minutes, our gear was all packed, and we departed camp by flashlight, each of us strolling by the wounded man, his eyes blinking as he watched us go, his mouth moving wordlessly. When he walked by the wounded man, Gary leaned over and picked up the single-shot shotgun from where it lay in the weeds. He opened the breech and ejected the spent round. He leaned over and patted the wounded man's pockets, finding a half-dozen or so shells in a pants pocket. I waited on a comment from Walt and Katie, but there was none. The last surprise of the night came about a mile down the trail when we came to an area where the trail was torn up and the bushes were crushed and broken. It was clear that an ATV had been parked here, probably while our attackers stalked the trail looking for us. It was also clear that whoever had been parked there had left in a hurry, swinging wide and accelerating too fast, causing the rear end of the four-wheeler to slew about on the muddy trail. They had grazed a thick cluster of rhododendron in their haste, losing one of the packs we'd noticed on their ATV earlier. It lay in the dense brush, a single shoulder strap caught on a broken branch and holding the pack upright. I looked at Gary, who shrugged. In different times, I wouldn't take another man's gear, I said to him. I think the original owner of this pack is probably dead or long gone, and its last owner had no right to it. I'm not going to leave gear out here that may help us on our journey. I can't carry that, Randy said, staring at the large and overstuffed pack. You're not ready for it yet, I said. For now, we dump your gear in my pack, and you can carry that. It's a little smaller. I'll carry the Gregory pack, and we'll sort through the gear later and adjust the loads. Works for me, she said. She was not quite so sure that it would work for her once she actually slung my pack on her back. Even though it was only a low-volume weekend pack, it was still pretty heavy. Her eyes widened for a moment, and she staggered, adjusting to the weight. But once we got the straps and waist belt adjusted, she said that it was in fact more comfortable than the pillowcase pack she'd been wearing. I started to toss the pillowcase pack, but ended up stuffing it in a side pocket of the Gregory pack for now. I shouldered the Gregory pack, and it was clear that this was indeed a thru-hiker's pack. It must have weighed 50 pounds, though the pack's excellent suspension did a good job of handling the weight. I quickly adjusted the straps, belt, and load lifters, and had it tuned to my body in a moment. We started walking again, heading for the Blue Ridge Parkway and my friend Lloyd's house. Chapter 19. We reached the Blue Ridge Parkway while it was still dark and began following it west. After the embrace of the deep forest, the open road made me feel exposed and vulnerable. In the circle illuminated by our flashlights, this could have been any road. By the time the sky lightened and the world became visible, we found that our highway was little more than a paved ledge looking out over dozens of rounded peaks and fog-filled valleys. Under other circumstances, it would have been a breathtaking sight. By 6:30 a.m., we'd been walking about 4 hours, and we took a break at a scenic overlook. There was a picnic shelter, and more importantly, pit toilets. A luxury after what we'd become used to, even though they were really just cinder-block outhouses painted in Park Service brown. Under the shelter, we sat on brown log tables, watching the sunrise over the horizon. After a few moments' break, and after using the facilities, Walt and Katie stood and gathered their gear. "We appreciate the help," Katie said. "We're going to take off and find our own way home from here." They'd apparently been talking among themselves as we walked and come to some conclusions. I shrugged. Gary had no comment either.
I appreciate your help, too, Walt said. We're just going to hit the highway and see if we might be able to catch a ride from there. It'll be faster. It was obvious that they were just being polite. There were philosophical differences between our groups, and they didn't agree with our tactics. With their lack of information, they had no idea what they were walking into. They thought things would be better on the road, that they could hitchhike or walk and everything would be okay. We tried to tell them differently, but you couldn't make people's decisions for them. They would have to find out on their own. "Be very careful," Randy warned, "and don't trust anyone. It's really bad down there." Katie smiled at Randy. "We appreciate it," she said. "We'll be careful. We'll look out for each other."
"Good luck," I told them. "You'll need it."
They pulled on their packs, took up their trekking poles, and strode away. I'm sure they were relieved to be free of us. I hoped things went well for them. If they couldn't handle what they'd seen with us over the last day or two, they would most certainly have a hard time finding their way in the world that awaited them.
"I'm hungry," Gary said.
We divvied up some of the remaining vending machine loot and tore into it less than enthusiastically. Holding a granola bar in his teeth, Gary dug in his pack and came up with a flattened cardboard sleeve wrapped in electrical tape. From the open end, he shook out a half a hacksaw blade and began sawing off the barrel of the shotgun he'd taken from the wounded man. He obviously wanted to reduce the weapon to a more user-friendly and concealable size. While he did that, I took time to get my own gear reorganized. Starting with the outside pockets of the Gregory pack, I sorted through the gear inside it. I unzipped the pocket in the pack lid and came up with a blue nylon wallet. I opened it and immediately found a driver's license, a little cash, and a credit card all wrapped together with a rubber band. The license had been issued in Vermont to a Larry Baxter, a 56-year-old man with a graying buzz cut and blue eyes. From the picture, I could see that neither of the men on the ATV was Larry Baxter. I considered whether I should hold on to the wallet and attempt to get it back to Larry Baxter when I made it home, if he was even still alive. This was outweighed by my concern at being caught with another man's identification and possibly being accused of theft, or even worse. I gathered the wallet with all its contents and tossed them in a nearby trash can. The rest of the pockets contained bits of gear that a hiker might need during the day. Spare batteries, a headlamp, ibuprofen, moleskin for blisters, a water pump, and a bandana. There was a cell phone and a charger in one of the pockets. It was dead, and I threw it in the trash along with a copy of Paul Bowles' The Sheltering Sky, which was bookmarked about halfway through and showing significant trail wear. Inside the main compartment of the pack, I found a nice down-filled marmot sleeping bag, which I kept. There was a one-man MSR tent, which I did not keep. It was a damn good tent, and one I'd specifically looked at before when shopping for tents. I knew it was less versatile, though, than the shelter materials I already carried, and my pack was way heavier than I wanted it to be. Throwing away good gear gave me a pang of guilt. And I still had a long way to go, and both my speed and agility would be affected by carrying too much gear. It also increased the risk of injury. I'd once strained my IT band, likely from carrying a too heavy pack, and had still had to go 27 more miles on the injured leg. It made for a very difficult hike, and I spent 3 months limping when I got home. There was some clothing, and I checked a tag for the size. It wouldn't fit me. I set aside the shirts and rain gear for Randy. The pants were too small for any of us, so I tossed them onto the pile I'd started with the tent. I would leave that gear here under the shelter, hoping that someone down the road may find it and benefit from it. I kept 2 pairs of hiking socks, a pair of light gloves, and a toboggan. There was a folding twig stove, which cooked food by means of a tiny fire built from twigs. With the stove was a cook set, which I put in the pile to discard. I did keep the utensil set, though. There was no food, no water bottles, and no other personal gear. I set about repacking the pack, taking the majority of my items from my get-home bag and finding room for them in the Gregory. I helped Randy repack my old pack with her gear and made certain that the strap adjustments were working for
By that time, Gary had finished removing the barrel from the shotgun. I knew he was done from the heavy clang of the barrel dropping onto the concrete. It bounced a few times, then rolled across the shelter and off the edge into the grass. Gary pulled a Leatherman multi-tool from his pack, selected a file, and removed any burrs from the barrel tip. When he was done with that step, he closed the file blade and unfolded a wood saw blade from the tool, sawing the shotgun's stock into a crude pistol grip. Despite the short blade length of the saw, it was extremely sharp, and Gary had his weapon done in short order. It was crudely done, but would pack a devastating punch at short range. He loaded a live round into the chamber and drew the hammer slightly back to the safe half-cocked position. "You gonna carry that thing?" I asked. "Not in the open," he said. "In my pack. It was too good a weapon to leave behind." "I agree," I said. "I must not have been thinking clearly up there last night. I should have thought of it. We need every asset that may help us get home. It would have been dumb to leave it."
"We were all a little rattled," Gary said. "Even soldiers have to get used to war. Our war is just starting."
I thought about what Gary said. Since shooting that man who tried to wrap a crowbar around Gary's head in the gas station parking lot, I'd been going through a lot of self-talk about focusing on our mission and not getting hung up on the violence. We were all still a little in shock from the turn of events of the past few days. I knew it was a collateral effect of events like the current terror attacks. I'd studied how people react in times of stress and chaos and had tried to prepare for it. I thought of my grandfather again, who'd carried a gun and knife every day of his adult life, dropping them in his pockets when he headed out the door like I did with car keys and a cell phone. I recalled a story my uncle told me at a family reunion, one of the few he attended. He was not very social either. He told me he'd been riding my grandfather's truck route with him one evening when he was about 12. This would have been in the early 1950s. It was fall, and my grandfather picked my uncle up when he got out of school so he could ride his route with him to a nearby town. My grandfather drove a small truck for a living, delivering meats and produce to small country stores. When they finished their route, it was about 7 p.m. The sun had already gone down, and the night had cooled. They stopped to eat. There was not much around except for a little beer joint on the side of the road called Buster's. It was a classic roadside beer joint with a low ceiling and stained hardwood floors covered in sawdust. My grandfather ate there whenever he made this late run and assured my uncle that their cheeseburgers were hard to beat. He was right. They both had large cheeseburgers and fried potatoes, and my uncle said it was one of the best burgers he'd ever had. On their way out, my grandfather lit a cigarette and smoked as they walked across the dark parking lot to his refrigerated truck. Their path took them across the front of the building and by a shed that housed the refrigeration equipment for the restaurant. When they passed that shed, a man stepped out of the shadows. My uncle said he could see the glint of a knife in the man's hand, and he froze. "I need some money," the man rasped, "and you're going to give me your goddamn money." My uncle said he peed his pants right there, but my grandfather had his hand in and out of his pocket in a second, coming out with a shrayed pocket knife and opening the blade. In those days, they didn't have all those fancy lock blade knives, tactical knives, and knives with pocket clips like we do now. It was just a plain old pocket knife with a long blade that my grandfather kept razor sharp. There was no further discussion, no threats, and no warning. My grandfather lashed out at the man, slashing him across the face, then stabbing him in the chest as the man staggered backward and dropped his own knife. The man continued to stagger backward, grasping his chest, trying to contain the dark ooze that seeped around his fingers. My grandfather stepped toward him, lashed out again, the knife flashing across the man's throat before the man finally fell. My uncle said that my grandfather stood there over the fallen man, his shoulders heaving as he sucked in air around the cigarette he hadn't even dropped in the scuffle. He'd acted so quickly and with such finality that he seemed like a man not of that time, but instead like a warrior of some distant culture brought forward to a modern time. Immediately behind the restaurant was a steep bank that dropped to the lead-colored Tug Fork River. It was here where the restaurant threw their trash.
It was also where the sinks and toilets of all the local homes emptied. It was into this river that everyone in the county threw their old tires and appliances. And it was where my grandfather threw the drunken, bleeding, and dying man who dared pull a knife on him and his son. He rolled the body and listened to the splash, watching the reflection in the water to see that it was moving downstream as it should and was not hung up on a root or rusting car frame. "Get in the truck," he'd said to my uncle. My grandfather pulled a greasy rag from under his truck seat and cleaned his knife, then his hands. The rag was thrown out the window on the way home. They drove on, and not a word was said about it. Not then, not ever. That was the kind of man I was going to have to be to make it home to my family. The kind of man who acted without hesitation during life-and-death situations. I was going to have to harden the fuck up. 60 years ago, this might have been the kind of country where a man could travel home and get help along the way from decent, trusting people. It was not that same America. For every good man in America, there was a drug addict wanting to steal from you. For every good woman, there was a deadbeat too lazy to work and waiting for a handout. For every child, there was a gang member, a sex offender, or a carjacker. This was not a group of co-workers coming home from a business trip anymore. This was war, and getting home was our mission. Gary's pack had a long pocket between the main load compartment and the padded back plate. It was for carrying a hydration bladder, which Gary did not bring on this trip. He doubled a piece of paracord and tied a single-point sling around the grip of the sawed-off shotgun, then shoved the shotgun into the hydration bladder pocket, where it was completely concealed from view. He tied the other end of the paracord sling to a D-ring on the shoulder strap of his pack. It was clear that his intent was to be able to use the sling to draw the weapon from his pack without having to remove his pack. The success of that would depend on how stuffed his pack was and how much friction the contents of his pack placed on that sleeve. He must have read my mind, or my look, which I've never been very good at masking. "We'll see how it works," he said. "Hopefully I can yank it out of there without shooting myself or someone else." I powered up my GPS. While I waited for it to sync up with the satellite network, I double-checked my weapon and made sure the magazine was full. It was then that it occurred to me that I'd not replenished Randy's magazine from when she emptied it last night. "Randy, pass me that pistol." She removed it from her back pocket and offered it to me. I pressed the magazine release and dropped the magazine into my palm. Empty. I was glad I'd thought of this before she needed the weapon. The hollow point rounds for this weapon came in boxes of 25 rounds, and I refilled the magazine from the partial box of critical defense rounds in my pack. When I ran out of these, I still had a full box of 50 rounds of 380 ball ammo. It would still punch holes, just considerably less damaging ones than the hollow points. When I returned the full LCP to her, I reminded her that the weapon was ready to go and to be careful with it. She rolled her eyes at me. "Grew up with guns?" she reminded me in a sarcastic, lilting voice. "Remember?" My GPS was fully synced and indicated that it was accurate to within 15 feet of my position. I zoomed out and used the GPS's waypoint tools to do a quick measurement from our current location to where I approximated Lloyd's house to be. This type of route measurement was not completely accurate because the handheld unit made it difficult to trace all the twists and turns of the road, but I came up with a distance of 8.3 miles. I repeated the distance out loud. "How does that translate into hours?" Randy asked. "How much longer am I going to have to be walking?" "If we're going mostly downhill on this paved surface, we might do 3 miles an hour or better," I said. "With brakes, let's say 3 hours or so." "I can do 3 hours, I think," she said. Then she added as an afterthought, "I'm out of cigarettes now." "Good," I said. "Bastard," she snarled. "You're the one who's going to have to listen to the complaining." I smiled. "No, I won't. You'll be too winded to complain. If you have breath for complaining, we're not walking fast enough. If you complain, I'll just step up the pace until you can't complain anymore. Keep that in mind."
She mulled this over. You're not just a bastard. You're a cruel bastard. Let's go. We've got miles to burn.
Chapter 20. Through most of my hiking experiences, I was always excited to return to walking after a break. I enjoyed the breaks, too, slumped against my backpack, enjoying a view, but there was something about the resumption of the trip that always carried great potential. It was where the world opened up to you. Walking the trail was where you saw things, the views, the wildlife, the indescribable play of light that photographs almost always failed to capture. However, the pleasure of resuming our walk on this beautiful day, in this beautiful place, was short-lived. We were walking in a straight line on the shoulder of the road, taking long strides and eating up ground. I was on point, Gary at the rear. We stayed close to the shoulder so we could duck over the edge of the road if we saw or heard someone coming. For the first mile or so, there was nothing to be concerned about. Then a scream cut through the near silence. We all flinched, hands moving toward weapons, muscles tensing.
"What the fuck?" Randy said.
"That was close," Gary said, "just around one of those bends in the road."
The road followed the contour of the mountaintop, snaking around every shoulder, ridge, abutment, outcropping, or draw in the mountain, making it nearly impossible to see for any distance at all.
"What are we going to do?" Randy asked.
Another scream came, dropping to an anguished wail.
"That sounds like Katie," I said.
"Shit," Gary muttered.
"I'm going to take a look," I said. "Do you guys want to stay here or come with me?"
Gary and Randy exchanged a quick glance before replying that they were coming with me. I dropped over the weedy shoulder of the road and started following the direction of the road, walking along an angled bank that offered some concealment from the road. The grassy bank was dew-soaked, and we were constantly losing traction and sliding. After several minutes of fighting with the wet bank, we arrived at the source of the screaming. I held up a hand, stopping Randy and Gary behind me. We dropped against the bank, creeping higher on the shoulder. Through the weeds, we could see three ATVs, one of them with a trailer hooked to it. Four men and two women were scattered among the ATVs. I recognized one of the men and one of the ATVs from the day before. It was the passenger with the jail tattoos. He was probably the partner of the man we'd killed last night. He made his way back to his family or some group of lowlifes that gave a shit about them. Now he was back with reinforcements. At the center of the group was Katie. She was on her knees on the ground, her hands resting on Walt's still body, a puddle of blood running from beneath him. I could not immediately see how he'd been injured or killed, but there was a lot of blood. The older of the two women stepped forward and grabbed a handful of Katie's hair, pulling her away from Walt's body and onto her back. She dragged her for a short distance, and then began kicking and stomping Katie, still holding her by the hair. Katie screamed and tried to protect herself, but it was useless. All she could do was try to protect her head and face from the blows and kicks raining down on her.
"What did you do to my son, you fucking bitch?"
The woman kept screaming at Katie, her voice harsh and raspy.
"Did you kill my son? Was it you that killed him?"
Katie sobbed, unable to respond. She looked like she was going into shock. The other woman, much younger, likely a sister or someone's wife, stepped forward and kicked Katie in the back right over the kidney. She then landed a series of punches on the side of Katie's face one after another, hurling abuse at her the whole time. After the last blow, she slung Katie by the hair. Katie sprawled onto the pavement. The woman bent and spit into Katie's face. The men surrounding the fight did nothing to stop it. In fact, they looked amused by the whole thing, smiling and joking. One even lit up a cigarette.
"I like a good catfight," the man from last night said. "What I wouldn't give for a scoped rifle," Gary whispered beside me. "Even a .22 caliber would be an improvement. We've got nothing that's accurate at this range."
It was probably a little less than 100 yards to where all of this was taking place, and our handguns with open sights were insufficient for the job.
"What do we do?" I asked. "Do we leave her?"
Do we wait for them to leave and let things play out?
That girl hasn't done anything, Randy said. I killed that old bitch's son. I don't want Katie to die for something I did.
What do you propose we do? I asked her. She looked at me like I was an idiot.
Why don't we just rush them, she said. They're all looking the other way. By the time they notice us, we'll be close enough to shoot them.
Gary and I looked at each other.
Might work, Gary said. We'd have to be quiet and move quickly.
The younger woman who'd punched Katie and spit on her now stood over Katie's body, staring down at her with disgust, her breath heaving.
Fucking bitch, she said. Let's just kill her now. She ain't gonna tell us shit.
The woman reached into her back pocket and withdrew what looked like a .22 caliber mini-revolver, probably a North American Arms model. She put a thumb on the hammer and pointed the gun at Katie's head.
Let me kill her, Mom, she said coldly. Please, just let me kill her.
The older woman looked down at Katie's trembling, blood-spattered form and shook her head.
No one's killing her until I know what happened to my baby.
The older woman, apparently the mother of the man we'd killed, walked to the ATV cart and returned with an old-fashioned butcher knife.
Last chance, girl, the woman said to Katie. You start talking or I start cutting your pretty little face up. I've butchered livestock my whole life and I ain't scared of a little blood.
She'll do it, the man with the tattoo said.
She'll cut you, bitch. You better tell her what she wants to know.
We have to do this now.
Randy, you take the two on the farthest left, I said. I'll take the two on the farthest right. Gary, you take the center two.
Why do I get the center two? Gary said. That's where Katie is. I don't want to hit her.
I don't either, and you're a better shot than I am.
Gary didn't have anything to say to that.
Let's hit it, I said. We walk quickly toward them with weapons up. Don't run. Don't draw any attention. Take firm, quiet steps.
As soon as the first one turns, we start shooting. Remember your shooting lanes.
What the hell is a shooting lane? Randy asked. Just remember to shoot the ones I told you to shoot.
Why didn't you just say that instead of trying to be all tactical?
Sorry, I replied. Let's do this.
We shrugged out of our packs and checked our weapons. I confirmed that everyone was ready and started to stand. No one on the road noticed. Everyone in the group ahead of us had their eyes glued to the older woman waving a butcher knife toward Katie's face. I started to walk toward the group, checking to see that Gary and Randy were with me. I tried to check my speed to make sure that we were aligned as close as possible so no one would be out ahead and get shot when the chaos started. Ironically, it was Katie who saw us first. We had closed half the distance when Katie peeled her hands from her face. She was clearly in shock, accepting that she was going to be tortured and then die. The woman stood over her, talking to her in a low voice that kept us from understanding the words. We closed 10 more yards. Katie raised her head, and she was looking straight at us, blood running from her nose and mouth. Gravel was embedded in gashes and abrasions. 10 more yards, and the old woman noticed Katie's eyes, noticed her distraction. Maybe she even saw our reflection in her pupils. We were at 20 yards when the first head turned to us. It was the old woman who held the knife. Her hate-filled eyes widened, and she opened her mouth to yell something. The words never left her mouth. Gary's .40-caliber Hydroshock round caught her in the face and sheared everything from frontal lobe to brainstem. She dropped the knife and fell onto Katie. The man I'd seen the previous day, the one who was no doubt a partner of the one we'd killed last night, was in my sights. I'd planned on him being my first target. I was set to double-tap him center mass when he dropped behind an ATV. I started to pursue him, but saw my secondary target turn toward me. It was exactly like a shooting drill I practiced at home, shooting at spaced targets. The man was a little older than me, with a shaggy gray beard and long, unkempt hair. He wore a greasy T-shirt and blue mechanic pants. He raised a shirt tail to reach for a revolver, but I caught him before it came free of his waistband. Another double tap, one to the neck, one through the breastbone. He fell with a grunt. I returned my attention to my first target in time to see him roll into the ditch, partially obscured by an ATV. I fired at glimpses of him, but didn't connect. He scrambled up a short bank, dodging my shots, and disappeared into the tree line.
Randy was blasting away, not having much luck. The LCP had nearly non-existent sights, and her first shot, no doubt targeting center mass as we'd told her, went a little wide and caught a skinny guy that looked like a meth dealer in the arm. He grabbed for his arm, and she emptied the pistol at him, catching him again in the shoulder and once in the abdomen, and he went down. The remaining man, 40-ish, with greasy black hair, stubble, and a dirt-covered face, dropped behind the ATV trailer. Gary and I both plowed rounds into it, punching holes in the plastic sides of the trailer and dropping the man behind it. I turned my eyes back to the remaining woman in time to catch her raising that tiny revolver on Randy. Before my brain could tell my hand to center up on her, she thumbed and dropped the hammer, firing a .22 round in our direction. Randy screamed, and the woman's thumb began to draw the hammer back again for a second shot. By this time, Gary and I were both moving our weapons to target the woman. Just before we fired, we saw a blur of movement in front of her. The movement caused me to hesitate for a fraction of a second. It was the butcher knife in Katie's blood-stained hand that caught my eye, and there was a brief flash of reflection from the blade as it plunged into the vile woman's abdomen. She doubled over in pain, dropping the pistol. Katie withdrew the knife and was on her instantly. She pulled the woman down to the pavement, plunging the knife repeatedly into her chest and neck. Katie's violence was the only sound in the great silence of the parkway. Gary and I watched until her movements slowed and she dropped the knife. She fell over, sobbing, curling into the fetal position. "Cover me," I yelled at Gary. I scrambled up the bank and looked for the man who'd escaped me. I could see the trail he'd taken. The broken branches, displaced rocks, missing chunks of moss, but I would not pursue him. He was probably in there waiting for me to do that. I knew, though, that by leaving him alive, I was taking a big chance. Aside from the one that got away, everyone in that group had been hit at least once. They'd all dropped, but I didn't know if any of them were still dangerous or not, and I had to check on Randy. When I returned to the road, I holstered my weapon, closing the steps to where she fell and was holding her face, blood seeping between her fingers. She was cursing in a low voice, repeating the same words over and over. That was a good sign, at least. "Randy, where are you hit?" She continued her mumbling curses. I took her by the wrists and pried her hands from her face. It was immediately obvious that a round had simply grazed her cheek. "I'm a nurse," she hissed. "Give it to me straight. How bad is it?" "It's okay," I said. "It just grazed you. You'll be okay. You may not be able to smile for a few days, though." "Good thing there's nothing to fucking smile about then, isn't it?" she said. "It burns like hell." I yanked a bandana from my pocket and pressed it to the side of her head. "Hold this on the wound." "Great, a snot compress," she mumbled. She did as I asked, though, and I stood to assist Gary. He'd apparently checked everyone and was convinced they were no longer a threat. He was bent and digging in the pocket of one of the men. "What you got?" I asked. Gary held up a pack of Marlboro Lights. I held out my hand and he tossed them to me. I shook one loose and pulled it from the pack, sticking it between my lips. I took the lighter from my pocket, flicked it, and sucked the flame to the tip. At the sound, Randy's eyes opened and widened. I removed the cigarette from my mouth and handed it to her. "Good for what ails you." "Bless you," she said. "Don't thank me," I said. "Thank Gary." I turned to him. "They all dead?"
"No, but they will be before long. Nothing we can do."
Gary holstered his weapon and went to check Katie, who'd crawled over to Walt. Gary checked Walt first, then slowly drew his hand back. It was obvious that he was dead. I looked around, found an old ratty blanket in the ATV trailer, and draped it over Walt's body. Katie was no longer crying, but emitted a tired, wailing moan. Gary helped her stand and led her to one of the ATVs, helping her take a seat on one of the racks. It looked like exhaustion, hysteria, and shock all rolled into one. I jogged over to the shoulder of the road where we'd left our packs and returned with a first aid kit. I removed an antiseptic wipe and a butterfly closure, tossed the rest of the kit to Gary, and set to work on Randy's cheek. She was in a much better state with a cigarette in her hand, but still winced when I applied the antiseptic to her cheek. She called me a variety of colorful names, but I took it as a sign she was going to be fine. I wiped her cheek, my hands shaking as my body tried to burn off the excess adrenaline. It was a bad feeling, and I had become more familiar with it lately than I cared to be. From the corner of my eye, I could see that Gary really didn't know where to start with Katie. He was working on wiping the blood off of her, first using a handkerchief and water, then using alcohol wipes from the first aid kit. From the noise she was making, it was clear that she needed more than just bandaging. When I finished with Randy's cheek, she flipped her cigarette butt away and stood up. "I can take care of her," she said. "She needs a woman's help." "I'm sure Gary won't argue with you." With Katie in Randy's hands, Gary and I set about checking the bodies of the dead and dying. "Did we really have to kill all these people?" Gary asked. "This was a slaughter." "I don't know," I said. "Did you see an option I missed?"
"Not one that would have saved Katie's life."
"But this is a lot of dead people." "I agree. But I'd be a lot happier if there was one more among them. That one that escaped worries me."
"Is this what we turn into when things start going to hell?" Gary asked.
I thought about his question for a moment. "Them or us?" I finally said.
"All of us," he said. "Them or us. Do we all just turn into animals?"
"I don't know about that," I said. "I don't feel like I've turned into anything. I just want to get home, and I will rise to whatever level of violence is required to get me there. I don't think we've killed anyone other than people who left us no choice. If that's the kind of people that lay between us and home, I will pave the road with their bodies." I was dead fucking serious. I could tell there was a lot going on in Gary's head. Among all those things bouncing around in there, I was sure that he was asking himself if he had that level of resolve, if he was hard enough. "That guy may come back," I said. "We need to get our shit together and get out of here." We set to work. For lack of any better options, we piled the scant useful possessions of this group into the ATV trailer. There was a .270 caliber bolt-action rifle, an old Smith & Wesson .38 revolver, and the .22 mini revolver that Randy had been shot with. I'd seen those before, but never held one. It was indeed not much larger than a cigarette lighter. There was no boxed ammo, but we found several spare rounds for each weapon in the pockets of the people we'd killed. There were several knives of various sizes, all of low quality, and except for a fixed-blade hunting knife, we left them all on the bodies. We also collected several more packs of cigarettes and some lighters. If Randy didn't smoke the damn things, maybe we could trade them off for ammo or something useful. There was also a feed sack already in the trailer that held some canned food and utensils, as well as a couple of flashlights. "We need to get rid of these bodies, Gary. I don't want people seeing this and thinking we murdered innocent people."
"I agree," he said. "But I want someone keeping watch. I don't want that bastard shooting us in the back if he returns."
"Can we keep the ATVs?" Randy asked. "I guess so," I shrugged. "If we use these, we could be at Lloyd's in less than an hour, I bet." Randy maintained watch while I fetched our remaining gear from over the hill. Then Gary and I carried all the bodies, all dead now, and tossed them over the embankment. He got the feet, I got the shoulders, and it was tiring work. It was completely clear to me now where the term dead weight came from. When we were done, Gary stepped over to a rhododendron and sprayed it with the meager contents of his stomach. I turned my back. Killing didn't have any adverse effect on me, but seeing people throw up always weakened my stomach. It make a lot of sense. That's just how I was made. What the hell could I do about it? While Gary lost his lunch, I took all of the gear that we didn't need and tossed it over the shoulder onto the bodies. As I stood staring over the bank at the results of our conflict, Gary walked up to my side. "I think we should conceal them a little better," I said. Gary nodded. We each pulled out our belt knives and began hacking off branches that we threw down on the bodies.
We spread out and collected branches from a wide area to avoid making any one area look too cut back and perhaps draw undue attention. When we were done, the bodies were at least camouflaged and would only be spotted by someone